ideally see in 2010? Question mark. Okay. So I'm in charge for 2 years of the Atlas group that does that looks for exotic physics. I'm going to tell you a little bit how we're preparing for our first year. So I'll focus on, is it too loud or is it okay? It's okay. I'll focus on searches for new physics that can be done in the first year of running, and we're actively preparing for that. So we hope to have energies between 7 and 10 TeV in the center of mass, and integrated luminosities between 100 and 200 inverse picobarns, maybe more, maybe less. So for early searches, we will not yet have a mature understanding of the detector and backgrounds. So that has some implications on how we do these searches. So we focus right now on analyses that have simple topologies, or analyses that have very low backgrounds, very clean signatures, or things that are very, very spectacular that you would not expect at all in the standard model. Also, we have developed data-driven techniques to understand and estimate backgrounds. So the idea here is to rely less on Monte Carlo, and because tuning to Monte Carlo will take some time. Okay, so some general comments. So the LHC should, even at lower energy, should allow us to explore an energy regime beyond that of the Tevatron, even if we integrate less luminosity than the Tevatron has right now. They're up to 5 inverse femtobarns or so. So that means that the start of the LHC run is really different than the start of run 2, and I was involved in that. In that, in run 2, we knew that we wouldn't find anything in the 100 inverse picobarns because the energy went from 1.8 to 1.96, and we were expecting 100 to 200 inverse picobarns, and that's what we got from run 1. And so the focus was completely on measuring, that's the first thing we did, in the group that I was involved in, measuring W cross-sections and Z cross-sections. But at the LHC, it's a little different because even, you know, if you go to 7 TeV or 10 TeV, then you open a new high-mass regime and you can see if you find something. Okay, you don't necessarily need to have an excellent understanding of your detector yet. If you think about what we've heard about Z primes, for instance, if you see a bump in the invariant mass of electrons and you have essentially a sideband, you see the background above or below, you know, this is one example where it's hard to fake a signal. It could be a statistical fluctuation. You can look to make sure that it's not always the same channels that are firing and giving you some mass bump, but that's one pretty robust channel. The other thing to realize, of course, is most of our results will be limits on new physics. And this we can do quite early compared to discovery. Discovery requires a large significance. To say that something's not there at 95% confidence level is easier to do. So although it's less exciting than a discovery, the first limits from Atlas and CMS should be the best in the world. And also, they will make an important statement, that is that, you know, the LHC is now exploring territory that was not explored before. And we will start to reduce the existing new physics phase space. So here are some of the early analyses that we're thinking about. In red is things that I will talk about. Divided them between earliest analyses and early analyses. So in the earliest, we have the resonances like the W prime, Z prime, diphoton that you heard before, perhaps quark compositeness, maybe black holes, diejet resonances, and things like that. Early requires a bit more understanding of the backgrounds. And here I have in that category monojets, so that's a jet and missing the T by construction, diejet plus missing T, and eventually TT bar resonances, things like heavy quarks. So we have an active group here, and they're well aware of Bob Holden's models, so they'll be looking for that. Heavy neutrinos, and also a word about the Hidden Valley scenarios. By the way, Brian is giving a talk at UFT on Monday, so you can, unfortunately, I'm not there on Monday, but that will cover some hidden sector physics. Okay, so the other thing that we do, we don't necessarily focus on particular, you know, models. We try to look at signatures. Why do we do that? So we want to compare standard model predictions to data in various final states, whether or not somebody made a prediction for it. There's some bias that I've seen in sort of run one and run two. We were not looking, for instance, at monojets or dijets plus missing T because we didn't really have a model for it. Eventually, somebody, you know, mentioned ADD gravitons, and all of a sudden we do the search. We should really search a little bit, we should search everywhere and make background calculations. So you never know what could turn up, new physics, or even sometimes just things you didn't understand, badly understood backgrounds, detector effects. And like I said, if there isn't a popular model now, it could be one next year. Also, we have a tendency to focus on minimal versions of these models. Simple final states at hadron colliders, like jet plus missing two jets, must be examined. And I mentioned we didn't do it, it's just because there were no models. Also, eventually, if we're lucky, there's something called the inverse problem, and I hope we'll have this problem. So that problem is, if we find something, how will we know what it is? You know, you have some signal with a lot of jets and missing ET, can't really explain it with a standard model. Do you know if it's supersymmetry or something else? So if you want to determine what it is, you need to look at all the channels. So you need, you know, do you see anything in two jets plus missing ET, three jets plus missing ET, with one leptons, two leptons, et cetera, et cetera. And so when you start doing that, you need to understand all your signatures and your backgrounds for all signatures. So the first priority for our sort of exotic group is to make sure that we trigger on everything. So the collision rate will eventually be 40 megahertz. And we can't write all of this to tape. We need to reduce it by a factor of about 10 to the 5. So that's a big number. So if you have a signal or events that have very high PT isolated leptons or jets, that will go to tape. So that's not a problem. But what about other exotic things? You know, I often ask people what they hope to find at the LHC, if anything, and they often say, I hope it's something that nobody has thought of before, so something that's really new. And it's probably something that's going to be weird. You know, the question is, will we trigger on this? So what about events that move slowly? We don't take for granted, but everything is designed for particles coming out of the interaction point, coming out of the speed of light. If these are moving too slowly, we won't trigger on them. Particles that decay late. So this is an example, for instance, of this is in the context of a Hidden Valley scenario, but you have a particle that goes through, a little bit like a SM muon, through all the calorimetry, and then decays in the muon spectrometer. And you have this, all these sort of reconstructed muons. They're not necessarily muons. If they're too bunched together, we might not even trigger on it. If we do trigger on it, the first thing that people would think of is it's a nice air shower. If you could take some time to look at the event, you'll see that it points to a decay vertex. So you have to be careful. Maybe we trigger on those, maybe we don't, and I'll come back to that. Particles that decay to lepton jets, I'll say a word about that. Magnetic charges, so say a monopole. A monopole won't bend like you expect, like a regular particle. It will go straight, essentially. It doesn't bend much due to the magnetic field. So it looks like a very high momentum track because it's not bending, and it's ionizing a lot. And then we have very busy events. I'll come back to that later. And then I'll mention quarks. Well, if you've heard of quarks before, but I'll tell you what they are. But the bottom line that you need to remember, so people who work on models, is if you have an idea and you don't know if we can trigger on it, let us know. Okay? Because if we don't trigger on it, then these events are lost forever. Okay? And there are no trigger for unknown unknowns. Okay, so just to give you an example of a recent model that people in our group have spent some time just to make sure we could trigger on it. So this is a category, I should say, of models with a hidden valley. So in these models, you can potentially produce, if you've got enough energy, a bunch of heavy particles, and they can eventually decay to the standard model through some communicator. And these particles can produce, for instance, these particles can be low mass, and they would be boosted, and the leptons would be close together. Okay, and you can, these models can be embedded within some SUSY model or not. If they're within a SUSY model, you can sort of think that eventually you'll trigger on it because I've got a W here. It goes to CS, but it's going to go to the lepton. If I have a high PT lepton, I'll trigger on it. The worry is that these particles that could be a few hundred MeV, if they decay to two leptons, if the two leptons are too close together, and we're looking, say, at isolated leptons, we won't trigger on them. And what we found also is in our muon trigger system at level two, we rejected these type of events, so we had to make some changes. So about a year ago, there was a workshop in Seattle, and it came up with sort of generic models where you can produce particles of arbitrary mass that decay to lighter particles that can decay to leptons. And if you vary the kinematics of all these things, you can have essentially a bunch of leptons very close together or not, depending on the mass. And we made sure that for a vast fraction of the phase space, we could trigger on these things. But before we did that, our efficiency for these types of models was pretty low. And so that's one thing to keep in mind. Now, if you go extra exotic, you can think about quirks. So some signatures are just too strange for us to be able to trigger on. And so we hope that we can trigger on these things with associated high PT and standard model objects. So if you've ever heard about quirks, they're a little bit like quarks. So they would be, you introduce essentially heavy fermions and that are charged under a new SUN group. And essentially what happens here is they behave a little bit like QCD, but instead of lambda QCD being around 300 MeV, the mass of, I should say, instead of having the mass of the quarks below lambda QCD, the mass of those particles is much higher. And so they don't hadronize, okay, because there's not enough mass. Eventually, if you could pull them apart, you would hadronize them. And so what happens is they start interacting in the detector, and depending on their mass and the various properties, you can have, you know, these things going around. The tracking software will not reconstruct these tracks. We can't even simulate this. We can't reconstruct it, anything. So hopefully, you know, we'll be able to, if this exists, but the bottom line is sometimes it's a little too strange for us to. The detector is essentially built for high PT objects that go at the speed of light, like I said, coming from the center. Okay, so let's talk about the first things we'll see when we start colliding protons on protons are jets. In terms of new physics, we can look at contact interactions. So if there's a new interaction that starts to compete with QCD at high energy, and it could be because quarks are composite objects, or it could be gravity turning on in some other models. We should see some deviations with the standard model if you look at the PT distribution of those quarks. So the problem with that, if you remember from the mid-90s, CDF did see an excess at high PT, and it turned out to be PDFs, really. So we had more gluons at high X than we thought we had, and that generated this excess. And so what we do is focus on distributions that are much more robust, either with respect to PDFs or the jet energy scale. So if you get the jet energy scale wrong at very high PT, it can fake a compositeness signal. So the idea here, I don't know if you can read what this is, but it's to look at the variable where you count the number of jets in a very central region, and you count the number of jets that you get in a less central region, and you do this ratio. The standard model predicts something that's flat as a function of the energy. So that's nice, because it means that if you don't know what your energy scale is to within, you know, n percent, you won't fake a signal. However, if you've got something new turning on, then you should see this ratio start to change. And expressed in a similar way here, again, this ratio of the number of jets, you'll notice that this is CMS. And it's kind of interesting that I'm showing you CMS plots, because we have the student who does this on Atlas in the room, but I can't show it to you. So we can discuss this during coffee, sociological aspects of big collaborations. But they look the same, the plots. So I may need to kill all of you now. Okay, this is the same ratio, and it's nice, even in the ratio, you see a resonance appear. You could also do this in the Diagent mass spectrum and see a bump, but this shows you what you could do. So the limit from the Tevatron is about 3 TeV, and you see that we could easily exclude that, and this is with 10 inverse picobands. Okay, another thing that was mentioned earlier are dileptron resonances and diphoton resonances. So, as we saw, you have various kinds of Z primes that could do this. You could have a graviton in various models that decays to two leptons. You also have techneurons that could decay to, we have one analysis that looks at mu mu, for instance. So, in general, you have very large signal to background ratios for these. For these models. The background can be directly obtained from data, so you should see the very nice Drell-Yan spectrum. Here it starts at 500, but you know it keeps going up. And as I said, it's pretty hard to fake a resonance. So with early data and with potentially large systematic uncertainties, we can still extend the mass range explored by the Tevatron with a few tens of inverse picobands. The W prime is, in principle, the cross section is about 10 times larger, so that really helps. However, you're missing the other lepton to reconstruct an invariant mass. Again, the limits from the Tevatron are around 1 TeV. And the challenge is to understand this missing T-tail. So if you have a hot channel or a muon, for instance, a cosmic muon that stops in the calorimeter somewhere, you can fake these types of events here. So you need to understand you're missing the T-tail. But if you do that, the standard model background, you know, you can tell from here, this is essentially like one event, should stop at around 500 GeV. So if you start to see a lot of events here, especially with the sort of a Jacobian peak like that, then you may be in business. So for the W prime, even if we get extra backgrounds here, we think we can extend to about 1.5 TeV. So that's 50% higher with 20 to 30 inverse picobands compared to the Tevatron. Another potentially clean final state is a lepton, lepton, jet, jet. And we have two benchmark signals here. One is leptoquarks and the other is heavy neutrinos. Leptoquarks would be, in this case, pair-produced. And you get the LQ, LQ. For the heavy neutrinos, this is in the context of a left-right symmetric model. So you have a right-handed W that decays to a lepton, and a heavy neutrino, and in turn, the neutrino decays to a lepton, and you get two jets. So you take the invariant mass of all of this, you should get the W, the right-handed W. And in a similar way, a different analysis for leptoquarks, you can get a very nice resonance with order 100 inverse picobands. And again, you can get rid of the background. So resonance is pretty convincing if we see one. Another thing I like to see, of course, is basically the background disappearing, or at least some measure of the background. Okay, another potential thing that we can exclude very early on are classical black holes. So in a more generic category, I'd say high PT, high multiplicity events. Now, we've had some trigger issues with these because at level 3, we have a computing farm. And if it takes too much time to reconstruct events that are very, very busy, then the computer punts and says, you know, it's too complicated. And so we don't drop this event on the floor. It goes into some debug stream. But we've had to work on to make sure that we kept these events. Now that you know, it's not just black holes. It's a TT bar with many jets or very high PT jets or, you know, events, standard model events that would be very interesting, tails of distribution that we would just get rid of because, well, because it takes too much time to reconstruct them. So in the case of these black holes, what you expect are very spectacular final states with missing ET, leptons, and jets. And to give you an idea of using very basic cuts and using everything that you reconstruct, all the leptons and the jets, to build an invariant mass, it would basically look like this. So this would be your background. Of course, there are large uncertainties on this background because it's hard to simulate multi-jet events. But the signal would be substantial. Now, if you add a lepton to the mix, you see that you essentially get rid of the signal, the background. But like I said before, it's always nice to actually see the background going down and then something, you know, turning on. Here, you could think that, you know, something went wrong with your background calculation. Okay, so I'll talk about monojets a little bit. So there was an excess of monojets seen by UA1 in the 80s, and the excess was not observed by the computing experiment. The excess was probably due to some underestimated background, probably W, tau mu, or B backgrounds. And early on in run 1, nobody was looking at monojets. There was nothing. There was no model at the time. But it became popular again with the introduction of the ADD large extra dimension scenario. And so there were some run 1 searches performed by D0 and CDF. That said, we should have been looking anyway in monojets. You know, shouldn't wait for a model to be there. And there was no early run 2 search, so we decided to do one. And actually with a student of Cliff's. I gave a talk at McMaster, and you told me that you had a student who was working on these final states. I don't know if you remember. Hugo, yeah. So I called him, and he said, no, I'm leaving for finance. And a few months later, he said, I don't like finance. I want to do particle physics. So he worked on this. So this is just for you to just recall the scenario. So in this scenario, you have some large extra dimensions that could be, well, now we're constraining them, but up to 100 microns or so. And the idea is that at the very small scale, you have gravity is propagating in many these extra dimensions, and that could explain why gravity is so weak, because the potential will go as 1 over Rn plus 1, where this is the number of dimensions. Once you look far away, all the field lines get trapped, and so you revert back to the standard potential 1 over R far away. The bottom line, what we're looking for here, is essentially the production of a graviton and a gluon, or a quark and a graviton. The graviton we wouldn't see would go in those extra dimensions. And so you're stuck with one jet plus missing transverse energy. Okay, so for these, I'll go through jets plus missing ET, one jet, two jets, and three jets, just to give you a feel for how we calculate backgrounds for these analyses. So especially at the LHC, early on, we want to, like I said, rely on data-driven estimates as much as we can. You want to design an analysis that has a background calculation that can tolerate large systematics for the jet energy scale, resolution, PDF, et cetera, luminosity, et cetera. Once you set a limit, though, you suffer. But the idea is that you won't take a signal. You want something that's pretty robust. I'll show you how we do that. So, so you have a lot of backgrounds you need to take care of. The first set of backgrounds have to do with cosmic rays. As William showed, we have a high rate, and you can think that 300 GeV muons don't, you know, the rate for that is low, but the detector is big, and the probability of seeing something like that from the standard model is also very small. So it turns out that the cosmic ray background can be very large if you don't do anything about it. How do you generate, this was a lunch conversation actually, how do you generate missing ETs? You have one muon is coming in, and it will brem, so it stops somewhere in the calorimeter. And so you have a lot of energy that's deposited in one spot. It will be typically a EM shower. So you have maybe 400 GV deposited in your calorimeter, and there's nothing else to balance on the other side, right? And so you generate 400 GV of missing ET in the opposite direction. And so you need to take care of this with a set of cleanup cuts. I'll show you what we do. After that, a very scary background is the QCD diejet background, enormous cross sections. So what if you mismeasure a jet, or you have some dead region, or just because, you know, we have some holes in our calorimeters, if the jet goes there, right, typically you have a diejet event, so it's well balanced. If you severely mismeasure one jet, you generate missing ET. And so the essential cut for these types of analyses is to require that the missing ET does not point in the direction of a jet, because that tells you basically that the jet was mismeasured. So if you see two jets, the missing ET better not point in that direction. Once you've done that, you start to see a lot of electroweak background. So the large irreducible background is Z to mu nu plus jet, because one jet gives you essentially the signature. If you do a good job here, this will dominate. So 90% of your background will be Z to mu nu irreducible, and then W going to electron and neutrino where you've lost electron, you didn't reconstruct it. So to get rid of the badly reconstructed lepton, if we have any hint, of course, you know, we reject reconstructed lepton. If there's an electron in the event, we reject the event. But sometimes the electron is not properly reconstructed. So we reject anything that looks like a lepton. So if we've got a track, an isolated track that's greater than 10 GeV, we reject the event. If we have some calorimeter cluster in the EM calorimeter, it doesn't matter if you have a track or not, but it is very EM-like, we reject the event. Now, some jets actually will give you the signature, but we just throw them away. We want to make sure that we throw away all the leptons. So here I'm going to pick an example from CDF, because we haven't developed those cuts yet for ATLAS. We'll have to see what the data looks like and what the beam conditions are. To give you a feeling for how we clean up the event, we require, when we have an event with large missing ET, for instance, that there's a nice vertex. So there are nice tracks all coming from one point, and high-quality tracks. Okay, this is to make sure that a hard scattering occurred, and it reduces the cosmic ray contribution. We require that the jet EM fraction is greater than 0.1. So what this means is that we want to make sure that typically for a muon, the hadron calorimeter is pretty large. So most muons will stop in the hadron calorimeter. A real jet will deposit energy in the EM calorimeter and the hadronic calorimeter. So if all the energy is deposited in one calorimeter, or most of it, we throw the event away, because it looks too much like a cosmic ray. And as I said before, we start removing leptons. Okay, so if there's too much EM energy, like I said, throw it away. If we see an isolated track, we throw it away. Then We have typically a jet or more jets. For monojet, of course, we have one. So we ask that where we have tracking, that there be high-PT tracks pointing at this jet. Okay, so that, and more than one. So a real jet should have a bunch of tracks, it should be straight, and if you don't get this, then you'll be swamped by some other background. We throw away any event where the jet is close to, we call it chimney, but we have cracks and surfaces also in Atlas. So if the jet is going into a region of the calorimeter that's not well instrumented, there's a good chance that we mismeasured it. So we don't take any chances, you throw it away. And finally, there's this delta phi cut. You don't want the missing T to point anywhere near a jet. So once you've done that, the event is sort of clean. So the QCD background and the cosmic ray background is at the level of less than 10%. So what dominates then, the largest background, is Z2 mu nu. How can we measure that from the data? So Z2 mu nu plus one jet looks like this. You have a jet and the two neutrinos went somewhere. You don't know where they went. But you can calibrate this. So this is a high energy jet, you know, maybe 200 GeV, something like that. You can calibrate this using a Z2EE. You do see the electrons. And so you can have calculate what the cross section for Z plus a jet of 150 GeV is without relying on Monte Carlo. The other thing that it helps you to do is, even if you get, if your jet energy scale is wrong, right, you'll be, you know, you think that you're, this is 150 GeV jet, but it's really 170. It doesn't really matter because everything will be normalized to essentially what you see. If I was just choosing Monte Carlo, and I think I'm, you know, I'm taking the Monte Carlo cross section for 150 and a GeV, but my calorimeter is really calibrated at 130, I can make large mistakes. So this makes it quite robust in terms of jet energy scale. Okay, so that's how the electroweak background is calculated. And quickly, I'll tell you a little bit about the QCD background. How do we measure it in the data? So I'll skip the subtleties, but it's pretty straightforward. Is that if I have two jets going back to back, and this jet is 150 GeV. If I look at this other jet, or events that have a lot of missing T pointing in that direction, then I can see essentially how we are mismeasuring jets in our detector. And so I can do an extrapolation that's shown here. So this is the transverse energy of the second jet, where the missing T is pointing in that direction. The other jet is at least 150 GeV. So that means I've lost 100 GeV somewhere in the detector. It was mismeasured severely. Okay, at some point we stop counting jets. It's around, you know, between 20 and 15 GeV. If you go below that, you know, you say it's not a jet. So we can see actually, you know, the jets sort of disappear. And so we do this extrapolation in the data. And once you go below this, then you really have an event where you have one jet and the other, you know, you don't see at all. So that's one way of calculating it. And there are some little corrections that you need to do, but that's the basic idea. Now, does it work? Assuming that there's no signal that we didn't see, it seems to work pretty well. So depending on, this is the jet ET for the monojets, and this is the missing ET cut. And so we look, again, we didn't optimize for a particular model. This is sort of signature-based. We just looked at various ET cuts. And this is our predicted background, and this is what we see. So it turned out okay. The other thing that was mentioned previously was that you can do, you can count the number of neutrinos this way, and we did. And we actually did better than two LEP experiments that did the monophoton. So. Because the biggest background is, you see, is here, right? So if this is assuming that you have three neutrino families, you add another neutrino family, you're changing this background. So you can basically nail it that way. And this is what it looks like in reality. So this is a 400 GeV jet.
I decided to show you real data for and 420 GB of missing ET. And what you see, this is what you want to see. You want to see significant energy in both calorimeters. That's what the two colors represent. You want to see a lot of straight tracks going in that direction. You don't want to see anything pointing in that direction. This is the missing ET. The tracks that are bending here have a few hundred MeV. So straight tracks, high momentum. Tracks that bend, low momentum. So this is a nice event. The events that you don't want to see can look a little bit like this. So this one probably passed our selections because there was enough energy in the hadron compartment to get picked. When you look in more detail, you'll see that one track was reconstructed. It's not, you know, it's not exactly going through the middle. And you can actually see a muon going through. There are hits hit here in the muon chambers. So this is an example of a cosmic event, high energy, that hit the went through the detector, hit the bottom here, and deposited a lot of energy. At the same time, we had a collision tens of centimeters away. And so sometimes you will get these types of events that pass all your cuts. Okay, so on to digest plus missing ET. So the generic picture is that you produce two unstable particles that decay to something that's invisible in the jet. And it could be a quark going to quark neutralino, or it could be a leptoquark going to quark neutrino. So for leptoquark at the LHC and the Tevatron, we're looking at the pair production of leptoquarks. And so the production just depends on the mass of the, it's quite simple. The mass of the leptoquark and the strong coupling. These have a charge. The decay is a bit more complicated. So this is different than, say, at Hera, because we can study second and third generation leptoquarks without having to assume lepton flavor violation. We're not colliding just electrons on the quark, which restricts you to first generation. We can also study leptoquarks that couple to only quarks and neutrinos. For all three generations, they will all look basically the same. In the context of SUSY, so in run two at the Tevatron, and it's also true at the LHC, there's a lot of focus on M Sudra in a particular set of points, and that sort of capture the kinematics of supersymmetry. And people really focus their analyses on this. And when we were working on this at the beginning of run two, we noticed that nobody was working on this final state, digest plus missing ET. There was some limit from run one, but no limit from run two. And the reason is there's no M-Sugra solution here, so we won't look at digest plus missing ET. And so the run two limits were all here. So we just went, you know, didn't optimize for SUSY or anything. We just went and looked. And we have analyses. Well, Pierre Olivier will tell you about the detail of an analysis that's done in the context of Atlas. And again, we did this, and it seems to work. So we think we're confident that these types of techniques will work at the LHC. Finally, you can go into more M-Sugra-like territory, multi-jets and missing ET. Then it becomes a little bit more complicated for the QCD background, because before, in the case of the monojet, it was quite simple because you could do this extrapolation, and you really need to lose a jet completely, essentially, and that's rare. But when you have many jets, if you mismeasure, you know, two or something like that, you're missing your T vector, can swing in between. So it's less powerful to do the delta phi exclusion. And there are new techniques that have been developed to take care of that. Now, if you don't want to worry too much about missing ET, not missing ET, but the QCD background, you can think about requiring a high PT lepton. And this removes a large fraction of the QCD background. However, then you're stuck with top. And top becomes dominant. So W plus jets and top. And so you really need to understand top production because it's a big background for any SUSY search. And here, the beta-driven thing is to use the transverse mass of the lepton and the missing T to provide a control sample. So in top events, in W plus jets, you have a W, and you can reconstruct this transverse mass. Normally, in these analyses, you cut on the transverse mass. You ask that the transverse mass be greater than 100 to exclude the background. What they do here is they reverse the cut. So they say, they ask for all events below 100 GeV in transverse mass. And so this is a background enriched sample. It's dominated by top and W. And you can then look at what the missing T distribution is for these events. It turns out that in the control region and the single region is high transverse mass, control region is low transverse mass, they roughly have, or at least that's a prediction, the same missing T distribution. And so you can look in the data and sort of normalize yourself in the control region and then extrapolate to another region. And on the right-hand side, you have, this is a Monte Carlo test, a self-consistency test of the method. So you have a lot of background samples, and you know what the true composition of your background is, but you use these estimates and the techniques that we've discussed for QCD, et cetera, to estimate your background using data-driven techniques. And so the true is in black, and in red you've got what you would estimate. And if you had a signal, so this is a special Ansugra point, you know, it would be substantially above this. But so these estimates you can get directly from the data. The only Monte Carlo input here is that the control region and the signal region for your backgrounds have roughly the same missing T distribution. Okay, so to conclude, so provided that the LHC runs at high energy, and by high energy I mean of order 70 dB and higher, we'll be able to explore an energy regime beyond that of the Tevatron with low integrated luminosity. Okay, so with 100 or 200 inverse picobaryons and 7 to 10 TeV, we could find a W prime, for instance. Okay. Another point that I often make is that we need defensible systematics for high-peak electron and jets, but even early on, these do not have to be small for us to produce the best measurements. So even if the luminosity uncertainty is 20%, jet energy uncertainty is large, we can start excluding regions that have not been excluded yet. Okay, and I think I've mentioned this before. Early analyses will use robust data-driven techniques to estimate the background, and that's it.
Questions?
Yes.
So the distributions for the missing AT, how different would it be for a standard model than for other beyond the standard model particles? Would it be the same kind of distributions or?
Let me bring it back. So that, I think that's what I was showing on the top plots. Whoops. Okay, one more try and then I'll wave my hands. Did you see the SU3 distribution or? So this is people often either add all the ET of the objects in the event, including the missing ETs, and it gives you sort of, we call that the effective mass. Or you can look also, here we're just looking at the missing ET. So for one model, parameter with a set of parameters, you know, this is what you would expect. SU3 is close to what the Tevatron has excluded.
And so if you have masses that are in the TED range, you wouldn't see any active effects. You need more integrated luminosity. And this is, again, with different cuts. So it's a little different, but what it would look like. And again, this is a log plot.
Same sign leptons, I guess, are pretty clean signals too.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, in the left-right model that I mentioned, you can get same sign leptons from that.
Because you have anything that produces three or more W's.
In terms of the heavy quarks, you think? Yeah. we're looking at that. Yeah.
What's the period?